This is Adam Seth Turk with Fenton, Goldman, Turk, and Davidoff, and you are listening to the Real Talk Podcast.
And welcome to another episode of the Real Talk Podcast, episode 102. So you are actually one of the first in-person interviews that we're going to be doing in 2024. So I appreciate your time. Thank you for coming. Who do I have in the office today, or who do I have in the podcast studio today? Adam Seth Turk. Adam is a partner at Fenton, Golden, Turk, and Davidoff, LLP, where him and his team represent a list or a series of banks, buyers, sellers, sponsors, developers, and all those that are involved in the real estate space here in the state of New York. That's what I said. I said state. So you also do business in Westchester. I'm sure you'll go out in Long Island if needed, and you do a lot in New York City. We'll talk more about that in a second. Adam and I met at the closing table fairly recently. I suppose in person. I was in person, which is great. A huge proponent of in-person closings, in-person office face-to-face happenings since COVID. But we met in person at a closing. We just wanted to understand each other's businesses more. And he did a very good job on the other side of the deal. And I've met a lot of attorneys that were better perhaps on the other side than on my side. So always good to have excellent, sharp attorneys on board. Adam's a lifelong New Yorker, born in Brooklyn, also did a stint at Long Island, which I learned, and also currently resides in New Jersey with his wife and kids. He's a diehard Knicks and Rangers fan, while also supporting some of the other lowly teams in the state of New York. Please follow Adam on his social media and LinkedIn, which I will post in the show notes.
Thank you.
So, Adam, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Actually, the Knicks are doing fairly well this year.
They are doing fairly well this year. Unfortunately, hasn't been a great couple of weeks. But
that's the weeks, yes.
Listen, it's the middle of the season. It's the All-Star break. And
way to go.
I think it's going to be a very fun spring in Madison Square Garden this year.
As a lifelong New Yorker, are you a Jets or a Giants fan?
So I'm a Jets fan.
But you live in Jersey.
I do live in Jersey. Jersey
is Giants.
The majority of Jersey is Giants. But funny enough, I actually live incredibly close to the Jets and the Giants stadium, MetLife Stadium. Yeah, where I live, in the little, I guess, development where I live in, it used to be, not so much anymore because now the players make an incredible more amount of money, but it used to be a lot of the Jets used to rent the houses by me. When I was actually looking to buy a house, funny story is the house that I looked at was currently being rented by one of the running backs from the Jets. And it was a 4-bedroom house. So they had the master bedroom. I think one of the bedroom was for his kids. I think one of the bedroom was for his dogs. And the fourth bedroom was for his sneakers. But I'm more of a Jets fan. I would say my passion is really the Knicks and the Rangers. That emotionally affects me. Exactly. Like if I let the Jets losing emotionally affected me, I don't know what type of emotional state I would be in.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, the Rangers went to the playoffs last year. Perhaps they'll do it again this year.
That's the hope.
It's a long season ahead. So let's get the listeners to learn who you are, what your style is, by answering the following list of words or phrases or sentences in one or two, maybe three words. But, it could be one word. Just kind of right off the cuff.
Got it. Okay,
here we go. So the game show music is on, and the first question is the New York City office market.
Bubble, but stronger than people realize.
Okay. Rent stabilization and rent control.
Necessary.
The real deal.
TMZ.
Local Law 11.
Misunderstood.
Real estate reality television.
Fantastic Escape.
Call boards.
More like a Thanos. Mm-hmm. Like the Marvel movie. Okay. That's how I think of them.
Oh, Thanos. Very strong and powerful.
Very strong and powerful. They answer to no one. They just do whatever they want without any regard of what the repercussions are going to be.
It's great. We'll go into more of that later.
Yeah, sure.
Social media.
Fun but dangerous.
This is a big one. Local Law 97.
Important, but I also think overhyped.
Co-op condo managing agents.
Oscar the Grouch.
Affordable housing.
Necessary, depending on what the word affordable means. Yeah.
Mayor Eric Adams.
Overwhelmed.
Work from home policy.
Abused.
Gen Z.
Entitled.
Funny. The state's LLC transparency bill.
It's not going to get the results they want.
Yeah.
Problem is twofold. One is still very easy to get around, right? Like you just have straw people do. Or more importantly is, and not the new one, but the old one is, they're not actually using it as to catch money laundering. What they were doing is, if they would suspect money laundering was occurring, they were then using that data to back up their assumptions.
Right.
So it's
maybe another data point for
CIA
or...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, maybe it's also because maybe, you know, with the LLC laws, maybe because as far as I know, none of my clients were engaging in criminal enterprises. So it's never really been much of an issue to them. And there are other ways, you know, for... to ensure their privacy.
There's other ways.
That's right. Exactly.
I'm always fascinated by ski towns. I'm a big snowboarder and one of my passions in life. And the dynamic of real estate markets and ski towns are also interesting because let's just say maybe 20 years ago, 30 years ago, there's a movie like Blow. Let's just say Mexican cartels transporting drugs into the American territory using, let's just say, small ski town rich airports. And the money that it brings into those economies and the buyers of those homes that are $10, $20, $30 million homes. I'm not saying everybody's a criminal in Aspen. That's not going there. But I have to say, there's got to be some interesting money being brought into these small towns.
Yeah,
small little private airports that there's really no security, really. I've been to tons of these airports.
You know, even with the money, I was talking to one of the head sales managers at one of these very expensive buildings. And they were very honest with me. Like, Adam, like, you know, like, every single person that comes in here, we know exactly who they are. Like, they know exactly who they're selling these apartments to. It's not really a secret, you know, like, they know, you know, so I think there are other ways to get the information. But
it could be a piece of the puzzle is what you're saying.
It could be.
Okay. When you said Local Law 11 is misunderstood, can you tell me why?
So it's misunderstood. People look at Local Law 11 as saying, oh my God, you know, the building, they're going to incur all these costs and, you know, that obviously means they weren't maintaining it properly or something like that. Like, the way I explain Local Law 11 to my clients is very simple. Local Law 11 is the reason why you can walk down the street in the city and a brick's not going to fall on your head.
So you're not going to die.
Exactly. So it's very important. You know, it's within a cycle. And not only that, now everyone knows about it. So buildings aren't caught off guard by Local Law 11. Like, they plan for it for, you know, a good building is going to be planning for Local Law 11 for a couple of years before they even have to do it.
Okay.
So they budget it.
It's the 7, I believe. Right?
Yeah, exactly. So they budget for it. And, you know, they should have a good plan about what it's going to cost. And they also shouldn't let it get to the point where it's completely deteriorated, that they're going to have huge assessments to you know, for upcoming. But, yeah, so Local Law 11 is, again, not a bad thing at all. I think it's very necessary. Now, do I think there needs to be scaffolding for years and years and years on every building, on every block? No. I think that goes a little overboard. But the Local 11 itself, I think, is important. And just because a building is going through Local 11 or is going to have to go through Local 11 soon shouldn't really deter buyers if, you know, everything else looks good.
Okay. Speaking of local law, we're talking about Local Law 97 as well. Yeah. And you said it was overhyped. Now, for listeners that do not know, Mayor Eric Adams, who you said is overwhelmed, launched the Getting 97 Done. This is a Local Law 97 plan. It's aimed at cutting harmful carbon emissions from cities' large buildings. At the heart of this strategy is the implementation of Local 97, a groundbreaking law that was passed right before COVID with the goal of helping to achieve net zero emissions by 2050. Local Law 97, which was a major step in New York City's effort to combat climate change, mandates that the city's buildings reduce their greenhouse gas emissions significantly. So why... The intentions are great, just like Local Law 11.
Yeah.
Why is it overhyped?
Well, it's overhyped because if you're looking what they're trying to do, when they say reduce the greenhouse gas emissions, basically what they're saying is take out outdated technology, right? Outdated, you know, HVAC systems and boilers, stuff like that. In a lot of buildings, that was already happening. You have to remember, a lot of buildings that are, you know, are very well financially run, when old things would break, they would replace them with new, more efficient things. So I know,
gas,
I think,
number three, gas number four,
exactly,
boilers.
So yeah, really, for most buildings, you know, I think the original number was they thought it was going to affect something like 20% of buildings weren't going to be compliant. Now I think that number is even down to about 10%.
Oh, good.
That won't be in compliance by the time it comes into action. But I'm saying is they were already doing this. They were already moved. Well, is it going to make some buildings do it a little quicker than they were before? Yes, it will. And that's not a bad thing. What it's going to do is it's going to hurt a lot of the buildings that couldn't afford it to begin with.
That's right.
And the other problem is now what are they doing if they can't afford it? They're not saying, okay, well, we'll help you do it. They're saying, no, we're just going to fine you. Okay, if you don't have money to pay for it to begin with, fining you on the back end is not going to get them to do it any quicker either. Mm-hmm. So I think, again, you know,
punishing the poor,
basically, it's going to, well,
you're finding somebody for being,
yes, like, it's going to disproportionately, I don't want to say poor,
yeah,
but it's going to disproportionately affect condos and co-ops or buildings that aren't as financially secure as most are, as they should be, mm-hmm. right? Like, there are buildings that we know that are just getting by. Now, just getting by means, all right, if something breaks, we might not replace it. We might, you know, just put a Band-Aid on it and try to fix it and do like that. You're basically taking that option away. And I think that's going to hurt a lot of buildings.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. It's challenging the inevitable that's about to happen, and it's how buildings deal with it today and save up money to make sure that it's done by 2050.
Yeah, and saying, you know, getting it to, they want to be, it's kind of like saying, you know, in the 1980s, like, okay, we want, you know, we want to do, let's say, use cars, for example, right? We want better gas mileage in cars. They're going to make that a mandate. That sounds great. Well, the reality is car companies were always looking to be more, you know, gas efficient, and they are today. It's not because the government made them do it. It's just technology advances
yeah.
to a certain point where it's just more efficient, and the technology becomes cheap enough that they can do it, right? They're always going to want to replace an HVAC system with a more efficient one. And it happens to be that more efficient one is more environmentally friendly, which is great, but they're not doing it because of that. They're doing it because it's cheaper,
right.
and it makes more sense.
Sign of the times in technology moving forward, moving us forward. Let's go to the section called short form answers. Sure. We want the listeners to get to know who you are. Yes, you're a competent attorney, do a ton of deals, but let's, how about the human side of Adam Seth Turk? So give us where you're from and where you currently reside.
So I was born in Brooklyn.
Where?
Brookdale Hospital.
Okay.
Yeah, like real, like actual Brooklyn. Lived in Flatbush for a few years. So I moved to Long Island when I was about 3.
Flatbush actually has some cool neighborhoods.
Incredibly cool neighborhoods.
Wide roads.
Yeah.
Like wider than in Williamsburg, where we live.
Yeah.
So I don't know why.
Yeah, so I moved
to Long Island
when I was 3.
No?
Yeah, that's where I lost my Brooklyn accent. I was really born there. I wasn't really bred there. I was actually bred in Long Island. So Long Island, you know, I haven't really gotten very far in the Five Towns. I don't know if you're familiar with that in Nassau County.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, I've stayed pretty local. I went to college here, and then I did move back to Brooklyn for law school, so lived there for a bit. I then moved to the Upper West Side.
Are you a cutie?
I went to Queens College.
Queens
College for undergrad. Then I went to Brooklyn Law School.
Okay.
So I lived in Brooklyn then. I then moved to the Upper West Side for a while, where I met my, you know, very, very beautiful wife. Unfortunately, you know, my apartment in the city was not very conducive. We lived on West End and 101st Street. Yeah, great neighborhood.
Quiet. You're very mature for your age.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
Old wise soul.
I
would have went to Western Avenue. That's where the Jewish grandmas live.
That's exactly where the Jewish grandmas live. We actually got our apartment because unfortunately a Jewish grandma had passed away. So an apartment opened up, so we were able to get it. Yeah, so we lived there for a while. It was great.
Victor Mezuzah, you have to take it over?
Does that work? You know, I don't remember if there was one on the door if we had a put so long ago. I don't remember. But then we moved up to Forest Hills for a while. We're there for a few years. And then once my wife was pregnant with our second child, we were kind of done with an apartment living.
Did you have a single family housing for us?
No. We were in a regular junior 4 apartment, you know, a regular rental building.
Big apartments out there.
It was big. Fortunately, it wasn't big enough.
Of course.
Yeah. So once the second, exactly. Once the second kid was coming, and then now we're in New Jersey.
Okay.
Let me
parlay that into the next question. The second question will be your favorite city or state or town outside of Long Island, Jersey, Upper West Side, New York City, Brooklyn, Manhattan. Outside of that,
I would have to say, in terms of where I've been lucky enough to travel
a lot,
I would probably say I really like London.
Okay.
You know, I find London it's kind of like an old school version of New York, mm-hmm. right? I love the architecture there.
It's way older and way cleaner.
But that's what I'm saying. Like, but I still get that, the vibe. Like, I get the energy vibe.
New war vibes.
Yeah. Like, I just like it. Everything, you know, maybe I am an old soul.
Speaking of Local 11, I mean, the facade and landscape there is fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, New York is good, but.
No, it's on another level. Walking down the row houses and everything like that. I mean, you really can't beat it.
Can't beat it.
Yeah, easy to get there. Everyone on there, you know, speak the language, obviously.
Really?
So, you know, even riding the buses is fun. Like, everything about it, I I would say, I would have to say London.
And the food scene's pretty good, too.
Yes.
Yeah. Can't beat that.
No.
Very multicultural. And in a different way. New York is very diverse, too. But London being more closer to Europe and Eastern Europe. And
no, absolutely.
Being closer to certain parts of Asia. It's very interesting. Yeah. Diversity there. Okay, great. Good, great answer. Do you have a favorite social media platform? Or are you on it?
Yeah. So currently, I would say I'm on LinkedIn. Not as active as I should be. I'm on Facebook and Instagram, but I would say my Facebook is really just whatever's on my Instagram gets pushed onto the Facebook. I would say Instagram. You know, I like Instagram. I'm a very visual person.
Do you connect with clients on social media or?
Not so much clients. Definitely brokers and people in the industry and colleagues. Clients, not as much, only because, like, obviously if they want to cross that line, I'm fine with it. You know, I'm very open. I have no problem becoming friends with my clients. You know, I'm open about it, but I don't push it, right? I leave it up to them. If they just want to keep it strictly professional, they don't want to know anything about me personally, sure. I mean, that's fine too. So I'll never request a client as a follow. But if they follow me, I'll probably give them a follow
back. Yeah, why not?
Okay. Yeah. Your two all-time go-to New York City bars or restaurants or any type of establishment. You can't say MSG.
Okay, that actually would have been one of my answers.
Okay, you can't say Madison Square.
Okay, so I'm going to go a little bit outside the box here. So
all of the fries there are pretty good.
Exactly. So I keep kosher.
Mm-hmm.
So I will tell you, the kosher food scene over the past probably about 10 years has gone on a different level.
Skyrocketed.
I mean,
kosher restaurants are hard to get into.
It used to be, growing up, kosher restaurants were bland, tasteless, very, you know, didn't care about customers, nothing to write home about. Now they've really gotten to a different level. With that being said, my all-time favorite is a place called, Gottlieb's.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Gottlieb's in Williamsburg is the greatest chicken cutlet I've ever had.
Okay.
I love it. You go in there.
I learned it here.
Yeah.
The best chicken cutlet.
Greatest grilled chicken you ever had with the fried onions on it. And they have, like, it's an old school Jewish, I guess the word would be Heimish, really, you know, food.
Okay.
And, like, you got to go in there. You can't even bother to look at whatever the health rating is on the front door. Don't look. You don't want to know. It doesn't matter. Just know the food there is delicious. And the other one, Brooklyn, now they have an outpost on the Upper West Side of Miami, is a place called Izzy's Barbecue.
Oh, okay.
So Izzy's Barbecue, he is a kosher, he was one of the first, there are a few out there, but he was like the first real kosher, like legitimate pitmaster. Like,
isn't Izzy like more of like an Eastern European name?
Well, his name would be Israel.
Israel, oh yeah.
Okay. So he trained in Texas. He actually, I'm not a foodie, so like I'm going to mess this up, but I know he won not best kosher barbecue, but best barbecue in New York one year.
Okay.
Like out of all of them. So I would say those are my real go-tos.
Right. Good.
Yeah.
Now, do you have a new spot as of recent, modern times?
You know, I have three little kids now in a hug, so I don't.
You're out of the city.
Exactly. That's the problem, right? I don't live in the city anymore, so it's so hard.
For MSG.
Exactly. So other than, you know, getting to MSG at night, and usually I'll, you know, grab a slice of pizza on the way or eat there, I'm not really so up with the
food scene. No problem. No problem. Do you have any, it's kind of your life as of today, you have all these kids and you're busy and you're going to MSG. Do you have any life changes or other personal updates that you'd like to share with us?
The biggest personal update I've had in the past couple of years is I'm a little over 2 years into being a dog owner.
Okay, good.
Incredible. He's a little Cavapoo. He's the best. I actually got him because I actually helped my best friend in the world was buying an apartment, and I helped him, and I was his attorney, and I wasn't going to charge him. So he asked me, he goes, Adam, he's like, you know, what could I do? I'm like, I don't know. I'm like, you know, get something for my kids. And my wife and I, getting a dog was always in the plan.
Oh, sure.
She grew up with a dog. But we always felt, all right, while we're in an apartment, you know, we're not going to get a dog. And my kids are still little. We were going to wait. And then I said, oh, get something for my kids. And then he goes to me, he goes, and he knew this. He goes, what if I get you a dog? And I'm like, all right. And I spoke to my wife about it. And I'm like,
that's a big gift.
Great gift. But I wasn't going to do it without her. Okay. I spoke to her. We're like, listen, I know we wanted to wait, but like, You know, my daughter at the time, the littlest one, was 2. And, like, I always wanted my kids to really grow up with a dog.
Yeah.
And I know it's going to be hard. And I always said, listen, Adam, if you're going to take the bulk of the responsibility, then let's do it. And that's what I did. And to this day, I still, she does. Like, she takes care of him when she needs to. And she loves him and plays and everything like that. But I do the bulk of it. And we got the dog. And it's been 2 years. And it's been great. He comes to the office with me all the time. If you ever, you know,
the best,
I could tell you.
A dog at a closing table is the best, right?
You're ever at a closing and people start arguing, we're like, they're upset, or even now, we're just waiting around for something to happen. You bring a puppy into the closing table,
it's over.
Yeah. Everyone's like, great. They forget about the issues, no more fighting. So yeah, he's the best. He's been to a bunch of closings. He comes to the office with me pretty often.
It also lowers the tension. What was the stress?
Everything. Even having him in the office, all of my staff, they love him. It's been fantastic. So I would say that's the biggest real life update. Everything else, I mean, everything is just good. My kids are happy and healthy. What could be bad?
I like to ask this question to a lot of attorneys, lawyers, is why real estate? I mean, it's dynamic. It's very interesting. And perhaps it's not on television and advertised as much, but you could have got into sexier, I guess, quote unquote, sexier field, like criminal or prosecution, and you see a Law and Order, or you could go, you also got into like divorce law. It seems like they do fairly well in New York City. Also, New Yorkers with very, very wealthy New Yorkers that are just getting divorced. It seems like there's more money in certain areas. Why real estate?
So I sort of fell into real estate. So it's funny you say criminal. So I grew up around
criminals.
Actually, yes, but more importantly, a very prominent criminal defense attorney, top in the country. Anyway, and I thought that was going to be my life, right? I thought my life was going to be an episode of Law and Order. It was going to be fantastic.
Yeah.
So I always knew I was going to go to law school. So I went to law school. I took my first criminal law class, and I realized after about 10 minutes that I didn't have the stomach to do it.
What does that mean?
Because when you think about criminal law, right, you think about all the sexiness of it, right? You think about... Anytime you think of a lawyer, when they're at the top of their profession, they've reached the top of their profession, but you don't realize that they're literally one in a million, right? Mm-hmm. There are,
of course,
999, there are some of them that don't get to do what they do, make the money they do.
It's a public defense.
And the lifestyle, right? You have to deal with some pretty bad people sometimes. Mm-hmm. So I knew criminal wasn't going to do it. I needed a job for my first summer out of law school. And my mother knew of this person that went to our synagogue that worked in this business called title insurance.
Sounds so fun.
No idea what title insurance was.
It's part of the real estate. Exactly.
They don't teach you that your first year of law school. But all I knew was he worked in title insurance, and all of his clients were lawyers. And he's like, he agreed to meet with me. I don't know what my mother had to do to get him to meet with me. But anyway, I heard he was a nice guy. So he says, listen, go meet with him and talk to him. So I met to meet with him one day. Wasn't really a job interview or anything. It was he was going to send my resume around for the summer, and we're talking, and this was during the boom of the mid 2000s, and he goes, listen, Adam, I'll gladly send your resume around, but the truth is, like, I really like you. Like, I'm growing this business here. How would you like to come work for me? Still didn't have that much of an interest in it, but then something clicked in my head. I'm like, wait a minute. Here's my big issue: is if I say no, I have to leave this meeting, tell my mother that I was offered a job and I said no to it.
Sure.
That wasn't going to happen. Mm. So I shook his hand, said yes, and I started working for him. And honestly, from the time he was doing some pretty big, pretty interesting stuff, and I don't know how much, title insurance, but it's kind of a fun business. I was doing some fun stuff, and I kind of just became a real estate nerd.
Yeah. And also, I feel like title insurance or companies were kind of more running rampant and free with the money spent.
Oh, God. Yeah, it was ridiculous.
The attorneys to set in business, or they buy tickets for this and that.
So whatever. It was a free-for-all. But I really enjoyed it, and I realized, I'm like, wait a minute. I became kind of good about it. I like being able, especially, even egotistically, like, I love working in the city, right? I love being able to walk down the street and say, I did a deal in that building. You have no idea what's going on in that building. Like, all that stuff. And I got to meet some really fun people, dealing with people in all different areas, because everyone's buying apartments. So, like, I got to meet people in finance and entertainment and, other, real estate people and athletes. And I kind of fell in love with it. And I realized, hey, can you make a career out of this? And I just did. Yeah.
You became part of it at a fairly young age. I know my father was a lawyer, and he, not in our world, he was in the world of patent law.
Mm-hmm.
And when he became a partner, it was probably in his 50s,
yeah.
mid to late 50s. It took a while.
Mm-hmm.
And not knowing anything really about how law firms work or how law is structured, now how did you become a partner at such a young age? What are some of the tips that you were able to give to perhaps people that are in the law field, the field of law or lawyers that are currently
trying to
be partner?
So my story, and I guess this is sort of the ending to the whole title insurance story, was basically I graduated law school in 2008, mm-hmm. right when everything was going really wow. downhill.
Pretty bad.
So basically
to be hired.
Exactly. So the goal was, right, I had at that time, I was never going to be a practicing lawyer, right? I was going to literally work in title insurance for my entire career. Anyway, so I was basically taking off from, like, let's say, May of that year. I was going to take off, you know, I was still going to take the bar and get my license just because it was good to have. And I was going to take off May, you know, take the bar into the summer, go on a trip, and come back to work September. Took off in May. I'm doing all my bar review. And I basically got a call like 3 weeks before the bar from the person I was supposed to work for. Said, Adam, you know, I'm not really sure how to tell you this. You know, I'm leaving the company. I'm going somewhere else and I can't take you with
me. Oh, boy.
Like, great. Don't really want to deal with this anyway. I took the bar, talking to people, didn't know what I wanted to do. And then I went to meet with the people who were still left the title company. And they were like, listen, Adam, I know you really had nothing to do with this, but the reality is, you know what the market's like. You could stay if you want, but basically made it pretty clear they didn't really want me there. And more importantly, they weren't, the deal that I had arranged, they weren't going to honor it.
Right.
I wasn't going to get paid when
there's
I
was no money
when I wanted
going
to get
around.
Correct.
Basically. Even the people that worked in the title company probably were
yeah.
out.
So I interviewed at another couple of firms, but the problem with firms like me is like it's very hard, you know, they're not that big. So it's very hard to get to the top, right? Because they're usually, you know, if there's one guy, he's not going to make you a partner on behalf of his firm. And also at that time, I wasn't really feeling it. I'm like, I don't know, like this just happened to me. It was bad. I was single. I had nothing to do. My first partner at the time, the Davidoff of the firm, a Fenton, Goldman, Turk & Davidoff, he was kind of in the same boat. A little different. He was working for a real estate attorney and he was going to be his first associate. He was like, listen, sorry, you know, can't keep you on full time. It wasn't going to matter. And we had always spoke, you know, down the line. We're like, hey, you know, 5, 10, you know, whatever years, we went to law school together. We really like each other. Like, we're going to start our own firm once we really know what we're doing. Then we just sort of, when this all happened to both of us, we got together. We both like, I was lucky. I had a couple of job offers. I wasn't going to be jobless, but nothing I really liked. And we're like, you know, starting your own law firm, like, how hard is that really? Like, we kind of know what we're doing. We can do the deals. So we spoke to a few people that had done it. And keep in mind, these are people that were successful. So I took it with a grain of salt. But basically, everyone that had done it, they were all like, the ones that had did it, they all said, we're very glad we did it. And most are like, we wish we would have done it earlier.
Right.
Like, there's really no reason.
Yeah, that's the take. That's the driver. That's the take on this.
Then we met with the New York City Bar Association, this small law firm person. We met with her. We walk into the meeting with her. She goes, you guys are nuts. You're going to fail. Don't do it. I'm like, we came here for support. What are you doing? Anyway, we ended up doing it. The one thing we decided was that we needed a real office because we were like, if we worked from home, it wasn't going to work. We needed it to feel legitimate. So we rented an office on 57th Street. It was actually, keep in mind, we're two young little Jewish lawyers. We rented
West 57?
So, no, not no, down about 250 West 57th Street.
Not yet.
Yeah, we rented it from he did immigration law. And he was only in the office about 3 days a week. So we had literally like, yeah, we had like the windowless closet office. And he had the big corner office.
Got us on somewhere.
Super nice guy. He goes, listen, guys, whenever you want to take a meeting, use my office. No problem. So we were doing that. But he had an incredible African art collection. So we'd have these meetings, and they'd look at us, two little Jewish lawyers, and they'd see on the wall, like, oh, that's a great art collection you have. I'm like, yeah, you know, great. It's African art. We're very into it. But anyway, and just little by little, you know, little by little, our first client that we ever got was Brooklyn Law School, because my partner and I both went to Brooklyn Law School. They saw we had opened a law firm. We were partners in a law firm. They sent the fundraising person after us.
Oh, good.
And we met with the fundraising person, and I didn't have any money to give her at the time, but great. And she really liked us. And she goes, hey, by the way, I'm buying my first apartment. Can you guys represent me? I'm like, absolutely. And then we started our banking practice at the same time. We got our first bank, and I don't want to say luck because I do believe you make your own luck, but you know, we were trained very well. And because at the time people were like, how are you guys surviving? We were surviving because, yeah, the market was bad, but we started from nothing. So if we went from having 3 deals 1 month to 6 deals the next month, we doubled in productivity. So it was great. And, you know, we did that for a few years. And then we met our other partner who had a very large banking practice. We merged the practice because we had gotten to a point where, you know, I'm sure you see this in your business too. You get to a point where you either need to expand yourself or you need to decide if you want to bring in other people. So we hit that ceiling, right? We couldn't do it ourselves anymore. And when you only have a couple of people, you don't really need much of an infrastructure. But once you have a real firm and you have a lot of different, you need a lot bigger. It's not like, you know, you bring in a third person, so you just buy another computer. At some point, you need a computer system. You need a phone system. You need all that. You need all that tech stuff. So once we were doing that, you know, we had merged with, you know, a larger firm. Yeah. And, you know, now we're, you know, at the height, we were probably in a couple of years ago about 70 people. Now we're about 30, which I still think for what we do is we're a very nice size.
Does that include paralegal?
Yeah.
Admin staff?
Yeah, that includes pretty much everyone. I mean, we do have a couple of per diems that we use every now and then. But yeah, we have, you know, 30 people that are our people.
That's really, really impressive, you know, based on your age and having that. I mean, yeah. Even 30 people at your age, just under on payroll itself, I'm sure it could be scary.
Terrifying.
You know, absolutely terrifying. I have a couple, but
yeah.
You have 30. So this is a whole other level of...
Yeah.
A payroll tax and payroll fees, ADP, and whatever you're using, it's a lot.
Yeah.
But for your age, it's really, really, it's really something else. And I'm sure a lot of attorneys that are your age would probably aspire to be at least at that level. So that's great. Now, I kind of want to shift gears and pivot to, you know, the legal aspects of today's climate. You know, I see a lot of buyers, and even the ones that actually we referred you, they ended up taking somebody else because it was free because of their employer program, even though they still interviewed you. But they don't always use the right representation, and that sometimes becomes the pitfall of their deal, or they could probably have saved maybe 1 or 2 or 3 weeks or 4 weeks of their life and stress by using the right person. So, you know, but right now, what do you see in your biggest pitfall as a buyer or a seller, both sides? Let's just say 2-part question. And, you know, is it surprising to consumers if you see these pitfalls, or is it something that consumers kind of see from down the road that it might happen?
So I think the biggest pitfall is when you say hiring a lawyer. So the problem when you say hiring a lawyer is that's such a broad term, because I could tell you, when you graduate law school as a lawyer, you're completely and utterly useless. You do not know how to do a thing.
Law school didn't teach you anything about law?
Nothing. But the crazy part is when you get your license to practice law, you get to practice any type of law you want, right? That's a crazy concept. Like saying, you know, the example I use, like my father-in-law, right? He's a pediatric anesthesiologist, top doctor, top of his game, fantastic. But if I break my finger, he's not the guy I want to go to. So it's kind of the same thing with lawyers, and people don't always get that, especially transactional real estate. It's so specialized, right? If you ask
co-op, transactional real
estate, co-op too, but even transactional real estate in general, right? If you ask someone on the street, say, I have to hire a lawyer, their first is, oh, great, you're about to get into a fight, so you need a lawyer that is going to fight for you, you're going to win, and the other side is going to lose. Transactional real estate isn't like that.
No.
Right? There is no winners or losers. It's one of the few types of law that everyone gets to win. Right? Your client wants to buy or sell, my client wants to buy or sell. So the good lawyers, the transactional, it's not our job to fight with each other. It's basically our job to take the deal that you guys as brokers basically agreed upon. We take that framework and we just make sure that it gets into the contract, right? And then get it to the closing table and get it closed. It's not about how can I get one up on the other guy. And there's also, especially co-ops and condos and New York City, there's so many nuances. Like
a lot
I could tell you. So part of our practice, like I said, we represent lenders. We also represent lenders on the payoff end. If you don't understand co-ops and you're selling a co-op and your lawyer doesn't know that they have to order the stock and lease weeks or months in advance.
30 days.
Right? There's nothing you could do. That closing is getting adjourned.
Rude.
Yeah. Like, I can't tell you how often we'll get a call from our payoff department. Still happens.
How did it happen in 2024?
Because a lot, you know, listen, I could tell you, if I'm the buyer's lawyer, we literally put that into the contract for the seller, being just to remind them, say, hey, listen, so we actually put it in that seller lawyer agrees to basically order collateral within 30 days. Now, every good lawyer crosses it out, emails me back, say, Adam, we're going to do it. I can't have it in there because if I forget, I don't want my client suing me, you know, for negligence. So we like, sure, take it out. We know you. You'll do it anyway. But, you know, a lot of times the bank, if the buyer doesn't do it and they don't remind the seller to do it, it can easily get missed. And that delays everything. And nowadays, it's so important. Forget about German fees. Now, the big thing is, right, rate locks, right? 2 years ago, rate locks didn't matter because they would either extend the rate for free or if they had a relock, they would get a lower rate. Nowadays, that's not happening. These rate locks are becoming very, very difficult.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I would say the pitfalls are not using someone that understands it. On the buy end, not using someone that understands the due diligence that needs to be done. Right, like understands you got to go read the minutes, you got to review the financials, you got to review the offering plan, you got to submit a questionnaire nowadays. Like that to me is definitely part of due diligence that I see some people skip. You have to understand how to get the answer sometimes, right? You might have to ask once, they say no, but you know the answer exists. So instead of taking that no, you just have to figure out, all right, this person's useless to me. Let me see how I can go around them and get the answer from someone else.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Having a strong buy side on the due diligence is extremely important. Dale, I mean, we have a situation just happened recently. What is it with the, there's like a Fannie Mae, is there a new Fannie Mae regulation? Do you want to ask him what the situation we have is? It was something about an inspection, but even though we still closed with a bank?
Well, right now we're working on a deal where a bank is not approving a building because there's some safety inspection report that they need to confirm on. I think that apparently something went wrong in January with an inspection.
Okay.
Each confirm it.
Still closed.
But we've closed January 11th, and another bank, big bank, has approved the building as of February 2nd. So, yeah, no one's really sure.
So, yeah. So, a lot of times what these bank approvals sometimes do is they go on a yearly basis. So they'll have it approved for a certain period of time. So it's possible that one bank might have approved it last January. So they need to reapprove it in January, but that other bank had approved it in, let's say, March. So their approval is still good until the next go around. That could be. I don't, again, without knowing the specifics of this building and that unit, I can't tell you exactly.
We have another deal too. It's like something about local law inspection. It's failed and it's on the Fannie Mae do that lend list. Different deal. Different.
Yeah. I without knowing what it is.
Did Fannie Mae get stricter in the recent year?
I don't know if they got stricter. I think it's just more of, just like you said, listen, at the end of the day, the banks can do what they want.
Yeah.
They're not going to lend because they want to make sure that they can, like all these banks, if they want, they could portfolio the loans. Like they're just making a decision. They don't want to do that. So that's why they're saying it needs to be Fannie Mae.
Well, when a bank turns around and says no, as a buy-side agent doing, about buy-side lawyer during due diligence process, you find out that the bank is saying no for whatever reasons. Do you get involved? If so, what do you do or what can you do?
So what we'll usually do is, you know, I'll try to know that beforehand. So the first question, when I have my first call with my client, one of the things is, are you financing and who are you financing with?
Mm-hmm.
And now I know a lot of the people. So luckily, if they tell me it's someone that I know, I'll call them up. I'll be like, hey, just want to confirm that not only is this buyer good, but you have the building approved. We're not going to have issues. If it's someone I don't know or they're doing, you know, we get a lot of credit unions nowadays and things like that.
Well, like Rocket Mortgage or something.
Rocket Mortgage is a whole different issue.
With Turbo Mortgage.
Correct. All those. We try to, I'm very opinionated. So I'll always tell my client if they're using, you know, if they're using something like that, I'll be like, listen, I get it. They're giving you the best rate. I just want you to be prepared that there may be issues for it.
Mm-hmm.
But what we do is we'll ask them, right? We'll confirm with them, like, do me a favor, confirm with the person that the building is approved as well. And if it's not approved, what do they need?
Well, the unfortunate reality of the answers that you, the questions that you ask, the unfortunate reality of the answers that you'll get is from the banks.
Yeah.
Oh, it was approved on 6 months ago. We need an updated questionnaire. It was approved last week, but expired. We need an updated questionnaire.
Yeah.
So how do you get around that? And what is your response?
There really is no getting around it. It's just like I feel my job is, I'm very honest with my clients. I'm like, listen, if this doesn't happen, you should have a backup, right? Speak to another lender. Make sure you have a very solid, if you need to, have a solid mortgage contingency plan as well. Right. Be like, all right, make sure you, that mortgage contingency date, know when it is. And if you can't get it within that 30 days or the 45 days that we negotiate it, be prepared that we're going to have to either ask for an extension and or you're not, unfortunately, not going to be able to buy.
Right.
But there is no way around, right? There's no, you know, there is no magic wand I could wave and, you know, tell, hey, bank, you know, please, you know, they're good people. They'll pay it back. Give them the money. You have to take our word for it. They'll be like, I can even say, because we do the due diligence too. So we know that the bank is, I don't want to say overreaching, but we know the building's fine, but they look at it a different way. It could just be, I don't even want to say it's bank specific. It's literally underwriter specific, right? Yeah. You could just get a bad underwriter at a specific bank who's not reading something correctly, right? They're looking at the building's financials and they don't understand that line item, what it is, or they're reading something and they think it's a bigger issue than what it really is. And next thing you know, they flag it. And once it's flagged in the system, like, banks can't unsee things. Mm. So that's the other thing that I always caution. I'm like, don't ever send your bank more information than they're requesting. Like, under any circumstances, even if you think it's going to help you, doesn't matter. If they didn't ask for it, do not send it to them.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. And that's on the building side and the buyer side.
Oh. Every side.
Mm-hmm.
Every side.
Okay. You know, you do a lot of due diligence on the buy side. You look under the hood, basically, right? You're looking at what's going on in the building's financials, or what's going on in the profit and loss statement, what's going on in their next year's budget, that's what's going on in their insurance, what's going on in their proprietary lease and the offering plan.
Yeah.
You get to see a lot of meeting minutes. I'm always curious, right? What it's when you're looking under the hood and you read the meeting minutes, have you seen anything that is, first and foremost, let's tell the listeners what is in the meeting minutes.
Sure.
And also, have you seen anything interesting or like kind of surprising or funny without maybe disclosing names or addresses?
Sure. So I'll tell you. All right. It's funny you say that because people might always make fun of me. Like, I get back to being a real estate nerd. To me, reading board minutes is something I actually enjoy, right? I think it's fun. I could tell you some of these board minutes are better than any soap opera you've ever seen on television.
Okay.
Good. My favorite story is I was reading minutes for, it was a building on the Upper East Side once, and I'm reading the minutes. And for a few months, this was going on, big, big controversy. They had ordered new doorman and porter uniforms in a shade of green. Very lovely. They liked it.
Sure.
When it came back, it was not the right shade of green. It
happens sometimes.
And there was literally for like 3 months, they were going back and forth. What do they do? They were ordering. Some people are like, I like it more. I like that. And as a joke, you know, when I give my due diligence support, I always like to interject a little humor. I told my clients, I'm like, guys, like, I don't know if you want to buy this building, right? There's a huge controversy. And if they have to get new ones, there's going to be assessment as a joke. They came back like, Adam, don't worry about it. I'm actually colorblind. I thought it was blue to begin with. No, but the reality is, minutes for the most part, 99 out of 100 times, minutes are actually useless.
Yeah.
What do I mean by that?
Okay.
They keep them sanitized, right? They know. Buildings know. They know what we're looking for, and they keep that stuff out of it. The problem is you still need to do it because I don't get to go to my client and be like, well, I know these are in the minutes, but the other 99 clients that I did this for was useless, so I skipped it with you. You don't get to do that. So we still do it. I've seen buildings, some of them meet, you know, 12 times a year. And then especially lately with COVID, I've gone to read minutes. And in the past 3 years, they have 2 board minutes.
Jeez.
And there's nothing in them. That's why nowadays getting that questionnaire done is so important. But no, for minutes we always look, obviously, if our unit that we're looking at is mentioned in anything, good or bad. We always look at that. We like to see, you know, if they do allow subleases in the co-op, have they been approving a lot of them lately? You know, you want to see, wow, are they very good with that? Is there any infighting, you know, are they saying, you know, Sam in 2B is, you know, stinking up the joint or something like that, you know? Stuff like that, we like to see.
Insert shrieks, insert screams, insert drama.
Yeah, you know, again, like they keep that a little bit sad, but also
Johnny from 2B.
Exactly. Like if there's any drama for anything like that, you know, problem neighbors.
Yeah. But do they put everything in there? And also, my question is, with all this technology, you know, with Zoom, can they just digitize it so you don't have to go there and read it? Like,
so they've been getting a little better about it. Pre-COVID, no, you were going, they would never. Now, Sun will release them to you if you sign an NDA. Or here's the kicker. Some we'll release them to you, but you still need to pay to read them. That's another fee.
Why do you have to pay to read somebody's?
Because management companies decide, hey, we have to push send on the email, so you need to pay.
That's like owners having to pay for financials for the building.
Correct. That, sure. That and a lot of times what they do is they're locked. So you could read them, but you could only read them for like 3 hours. So what we now need to, it used to be like when they would send it, we'd do it at our convenience. Now we have to literally set aside because the second we start, we need to be done within a certain period of time.
Do they take your phones away or can you take pictures of it?
They say, yeah, you can't photocopy it. So yeah, I've never tried because I can't imagine reading them off a remote. Yeah. Now we usually just bring our laptops and like we type them up as we go. The important stuff.
Okay.
Usually you want to see about increases. Are they talking about any assessments or talking about any changes, whether to the flip tax or rules like that or like that. So I could tell you what we do is our standard is we go back 2 years, but if we see something within those 2 years, we'll go back 4 years.
It's 2024, right? Let's digitize meeting minutes. Send us the Zoom file or do something. Don't let us go to the office.
Yeah.
To your office, not our office, but to the managing agent's office to read printed out paper.
Yeah.
Just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Not only that, they also use office very loosely. You know, an office could be, especially some of these management companies in Brooklyn, it could be, you know, a dungeon basement. Who knows? We just hope we're coming out of there.
That's right. That's right. Or we just did a closing in a building. Shout out BPC, interesting company.
Yeah.
But you know, walk in and the office is it's in Brooklyn Heights. The office, it's like straight out of the 70s, like the show.
Yeah, I just did a closing last week.
Really wild.
I kid you not, the seller's attorney's dining room table. Like, no, I've been, especially in Brooklyn, there are a lot of offices out there, and a lot of people have home offices, but they're actual home offices. Like,
yeah.
They've taken their townhouse, they've turned it, was sitting at her dining room table, tablecloth on and everything.
Old school.
Very old school.
In a modern world, still New York City.
Very, very, very old.
I want to switch gears now to talk about your due diligence on the questionnaire. What is kind of standard in the questionnaire? Why do people ask? And also, what are have you seen any interesting responses on a questionnaire? And also, one more thing at the end here. Managing agents they have to be almost always not 100%. I feel like they're like maybe 80% right on almost all questionnaires. And is that a true or false statement?
When you say 80%, you mean in terms of
actually filling it out in questions? I don't think they know what they're talking about.
They don't. most
of the time or all the time?
more than it should be, right?
Yeah.
When you submit a questionnaire, especially if you're paying for it, at the very least, you should expect, and now keep in mind, my questionnaires, right, a lot of the times, I know the answers anyway because I've done the due diligence, but I'm not going to take the question out. But the problem is I then send the questionnaire and it comes back and the answer that I already know, they gave the wrong answer.
Yeah.
And now I have to go back and I'm like, oh, but I already, and now I have to start questioning every other answer on that questionnaire. No, they don't bother to look.
Why is there no quality control there?
Because being a managing agent is a terrible job, right? You have to remember your job is for the most part to just handle everyone's complaints.
Yeah.
That's it. You just get abused.
Yeah.
And I get it. And they hate it. And
they're probably underpaid a little bit.
They are underpaid. And that's why you see so much consolidation in the industry because you have to do it in order to make money. You have to do it on such a large scale, right? You can't make money managing a building.
Sure.
You got to manage portfolios.
Okay.
And at the time, they don't care about customer service because they all stink. So it's not like, oh, you know, you're going to go to one management company and the other management company is no, they all think. None of them are good.
It's a merry-go-round.
It's a merry-go-round of, you know, mediocrity at best. So the questionnaire, it's very, very difficult. We basically end up getting the questionnaires, and if we think something is suspect, we have to send another email. We find, hey, got the questionnaire, but from our due diligence, it actually appears that this should be the answer. Can you double-check on that? And then they'll get back to us, and they'll double-check, and that's... But we need the questionnaire. Also, we also really need the questionnaire because financials, especially, like, even if you have the most up-to-date financials, they're still a year old because they're always from the year before.
Yeah.
So we still need the questionnaire because we need the most updated financial picture.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
But yeah, I mean, it's very difficult. Managing agents, it doesn't matter. You know, they don't care that your client might lose the deal because you don't have the, they don't care. Like they send it to you at their convenience, at their whim. Yeah, so it's hard.
There's a lot of regulations that are also kind of new in 2024. The most recent one that I heard of is something regarding property disclosure, and you get the $500 or not.
Yeah.
As a buyer, can you kind of elaborate into that?
So it used to be, it only applies to single family home. It doesn't apply to condos, apartments. It's really more single family homes. And so basically,
multifamily as well. Is it up to three family, four family? Or
I believe it's four family. Anyway, keep in mind, this is standard. Like when I bought my home in Jersey, this is standard pretty much everywhere else in the country, that the seller literally fills out a document letting you know everything they know about the house.
Good and bad.
Good and bad.
Good and bad.
Yeah, good and bad. Like saying the now there used to be a thing in New York where you could sort of get out of this by the seller simply giving the buyer a $500 credit.
That's right.
$500 PCDA credit. 100% of the time this would happen for a few reasons. One, the seller didn't want to do it, but meaning for $500, right, you're basically taking this huge liability off of the seller's back.
So it's actually a great deal for a seller.
It was great. It was great.
In New York City, at least. Because one little thing, one little contractor coming out is $500. Even for the smallest little thing.
So now they've changed it, saying, no, you could no longer just give that credit, right? It's not up to the seller anymore. The buyer is now entitled to this PCDA.
Yeah.
I've seen them going back and forth. I've spoken to a lot of people how it needs to work. You know, one thing I heard is that, okay, well, what we'll do is that the seller is going to hire an inspector beforehand because they don't want to fill it out. Well, the problem with that is anyone that's ever hired an inspector knows that an inspector's job is to find flaws that maybe you don't know about.
Maybe 10, 20 pages of them.
Exactly. Like I always say an inspector is very simple, right? You can get a brand new refrigerator. Brand new refrigerator. It gets delivered Monday. The inspector comes to look at it on Tuesday. They don't say you have a brand new refrigerator. They say your refrigerator only has 15 years of life left in it. That's how inspectors talk, right?
That's such a worrisome way to sell a refrigerator.
So if I'm a seller, I don't necessarily want to get an inspection to do this. So I don't really know how it's going to happen, right? I don't know if they'll just fill it out to the best of their knowledge and just say, hey, listen, just don't lie. You know, just be open and honest. Sure. I think that's always the best policy, you know.
If you're representing the seller, would you recommend them just go ahead and pay for the inspection anyway to get it out of the way or no?
I don't know. You know, I haven't, it's coming up in March, so I haven't really had to deal with it yet. You know, not to throw it back on you guys, but I think a lot of it's also going to come on the real estate broker.
Sure.
Right? You know, as a lawyer, I'm going to say, hey, listen, real estate broker, you know, you got to help him fill this out.
Yeah,
that's how it works in other places.
Done.
Exactly. You got to figure out a way to get this done, you know. So we'll see. Again, it doesn't apply to condos and co-ops. It doesn't apply to estates. It doesn't apply to, other than single family homes, actual people selling them.
And I think it really impacts, it impacts the seller of the single family or multifamily home. Let's just say, hypothetically, in Brooklyn, they close. 3 months later, they come back and they have a lawsuit on their.
Correct. Now, the nice thing is, especially in New York City, I mean, nobody's buying a single family house without an inspection. It's just not happening.
100%. What crazy buyer would do that?
Exactly. It's not, you know, in other places it happens. In New York, it doesn't. But I think that's going to help as well. So the buyer is always going to have an inspection report. So the chances of that, not of the inspector missing it and the seller not disclosing it, aren't going to be very high.
Yeah, that's true. I want to talk on another subject here. I know we're running out of time here, but non-resident tax. There is an issue that I had previously with some co-op buyers that bought a co-op and then they got hit with a tax saying that they were not.
Like, we hate having to do this, but we got to play the game and we just go back and forth, and then that's what it is. So I would say, you know, getting your clients to understand, first off, the fees that are involved so there are no surprises, and timeline.
Got it.
Those are the two biggest pitfalls that especially buyers don't always understand before actually signing their contract.
Okay. One final note. Do you have any favorite new construction projects that you worked on or any legal standpoint?
Favorite new construction. So the best building I ever worked on was, my favorite is 211th Avenue. That's the Sky Garage building.
Sky Garage.
I'm a bit of a car guy.
Young Who Associates.
I'm a bit of a car guy, so I love that.
Yeah.
Funny part about that is my client didn't even have a car at the time. She just liked the views. That's why she took there. Did Central Park Tower, which is...
Tell me about that. Why do you like Central Park Tower?
Central Park Tower to me is... maybe it was just a sales office. They just... First of all, I mean, Excel in general, they do... Their sales offices are just top-notch.
Who do they use for their law firm? Is it Newmark?
Different ones. No. Newmark, not for their law firm. You mean Holland?
Holland, sorry.
They use a few different ones that's been brought. Ectel actually now sometimes actually keeps a lot of that in-house. They have a very... I know it's like Brooklyn Point they do in-house. They do a lot of in-house, but the fit and finishes to me were, you can't really get much nicer. And I was actually talking to a salesperson there and asking her. They had, when I looked, they had vein-matched marble in the kitchen, I'm like, when people come in here, they must love this. And they go... They don't care. They're like 50% of the buyers. They're going to rip it out anyway.
Yep.
One was a little mind blowing to me.
But on the back end, the contractors are happy because they take it home.
Oh yeah.
Doesn't get wasted.
Yeah. I mean, I'm like I said, I'm a real estate nerd. So anytime I get to work in a top notch building.
Do you have a favorite building all time in New York City?
Favorite building all time. Oh, another one, just to go back on the other one. Another favorite current one that I've done a bunch of deals, 108 Leonard.
108 Leonard, yeah.
To me, that lobby is next level.
Of course, it is.
Yeah.
Now, is that called Civic Center or is that Tribeca? Because it is east of Broadway.
I don't get wrapped
real
up.
Real estate.
Yeah.
Oh, you don't get wrapped up?
Parts. I don't know. Whatever you want to put it on a map, it makes no difference.
It's a nice building. The overhead is a little bit higher, which makes the sales a little bit harder, but... And also, from an advertising standpoint, you get better analytics if you advertise as Tribeca. But if you advertise as Civic Center Chinatown, the analytics go down.
I never thought about it.
That's that real estate nerd in me.
That's a good one. All time favorite building. I'm going to have to say was the one in 15th Century Park West because it was right above the tree line, which to me is the best view. The high floor, it's cool, but you're so high that it doesn't matter. Like, you don't really see anything, you know? But when you're right above the tree line, I mean, you have a great, great view of the park. I would think that one. But I don't know if this is wood or not. I'm very lucky, right? I've gotten to work in some cool buildings with some really cool people. I've even got to close in some really cool places. You know, one I was doing for someone in the music industry, and the closing was... in the recording studio. Super cool. Like, other, you know, got the clothes, you know, for some very, you know, just really, like, well-known people, cool people. You know what? I shouldn't take it back. The coolest building I ever worked on is I got to do a deal. Did you own the Palazzo Chupi?
No.
Yeah, so that is, it's not Julian Schnabel's building.
Okay.
Google it after. It's the craziest building. It looks like a horse barn. Incredible. So I got to do a deal on that.
West Village?
Yeah. West Village. It was, I think, on maybe 12th Street.
Yeah. I think I know what you're talking about.
So I would say that one. That's probably the coolest one I've ever got.
Okay. Very cool. Well, Adam Seth Turk, everybody, we appreciate your time. Thank you for coming. Please follow him. I should plug your Instagram in there as well.
Yeah.
All of him is information on our show notes. And,
you
know, we hope to do a lot more business in 2024.
That's the plan.
All right.
Let's get these deals closed.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it for your time.